Hey everybody, it's Dave. Long time no see for sure. So I just wanted to say hello to everybody, all my listeners, everybody who has been wondering where the hell Dave's podcast, The Hunsdonian Hour, is. This is David Hunsdon again, for those of you who are the uninitiated. And yeah, I'm back. And I wish it was under a little bit better conditions, pretenses, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, obviously, you know, the passing of the great audio engineer, musician Steve Albini sucks. He died at his studio of a just unexpected heart attack. Past Tuesday night, May the 7th, and today I'm the evening of Saturday, May 11th, 2024, is when I'm recording this. So to pay tribute to him, I just thought I'd talk about, you know, his, those who aren't super aware, the underlying philosophy behind his records, how he approached the job of being an audio engineer, and yeah. And also what take like five records that I feel had the most impact on me personally, why they had such an impact, and kind of sum it up with, you know, some tributes, and also talk a little bit about his personal life and some of the things he said and did earlier in his career. I'll get into it. He's known for being like an edgelord, or what they say now. He was doing that in the 80s and 90s, and then he kind of, as he got older, regretted some of those things. They were not very cool, what he said and did, but he apologized, and he became a better person, and this is an immense loss, and I just can't underscore that enough. Fuck, I another one of these in memoriam of somebody that really was a big part of my youth and shaped who I am as a musician and an artist, and this sucks, but... life is fleeting and precious. Don't forget that. All right, let's get into it. Glad you're here. Dave, we're here at the Hunsdonian Hour. Thank you for joining me. So it's been a while, hasn't it? It's been a fucking minute. And I just want to start this off by saying thank you again for being here. And I wish the occasion was less heavy. The main purpose for this podcast, the subject is going to be Steve Albini, in honor of his untimely and goddamn, I can't believe I'm saying this, a recent passing just a few days ago, May 7th, 2024, at age 61 in Chicago. He was at Electrical Audio, his famed studio in Chicago, Illinois, working, and according to his employees, staff members, he had a heart attack and died. And Steve Albini has transition from this plane of existence, and we are very sad, we are shocked, we are hurt. We have so many more questions than answers, but apparently it was his time. And the good news is he left quite the body of work for us to listen to and enjoy, and plenty of funny memories and quotes and things people remember him for. And whenever we feel sad and we miss him, we got a plethora of art and music and things to remember him by. So I want to start off by saying that I'm sad and shocked, as all of you are, as everyone is. Can't imagine what it was like for his coworkers in the studio there. I hope they get the counseling or help or whatever they need, whatever comfort or that they can get to work through that. That's got to be horrible. Obviously, condolences to his family, friends, close associates, anybody who's close to Mr. Albini, and his wife. He's married. I believe she was the head of Second City Improv Comedy in Chicago. Heather Winna or something was his wife. But yeah, just horrible, horrible news. But we're gonna have as much hopefully have as much fun and as we can while honoring the gravity of the situation and respecting his legacy, but also, you know, paying tribute to him and Steve Albini, the recording engineer, the musician. This is going to focus mostly on the stuff he engineered. I have listened to Big Black. I have, I think, Rich Man's 8-track tape, which is what he called the CD when it came out. I have that. That's like an EP. And then I think I have songs about fucking somewhere, one with the girl on the cover of the anime looking dark haired chick with, she's like making groaning, you know, grimacing or whatever, clenching her teeth, like, you know, she's in having intercourse, which is what it was supposed to be implied there. But yeah, we're going to talk about Steve. We're going to talk about his body of work, talk about his reputation, his personality, his stories, people have memories people have of him, etc. And, I am going to talk about, I'm going to sing out 5 specific albums. Probably 3 of them are pretty universal. There's 2 in particular I wanted to highlight that I don't think, one for sure, but the other one as well, I don't think get mentioned enough in his discography that I think are fantastic and really show his range as a recording engineer, sound engineer. So that's what's on the agenda for today. And obviously, In Utero, you know, Nirvana, we're going to talk about that and talk about some other records and just remember him. And, you know, it's kind of a bummer. It is a bummer, absolutely. But it's a reminder that life is precious and fleeting. And I'm going to say it again before I sign off here. Life is so precious and it's fleeting. We don't know how much time we have, but we just got to make the most of it. And even though 61 seems pretty damn young, it is. Steve Albini made the most of his time here. There's no question about it. I think we'd all agree on that. And what a hell of a discography and what a hell of a guy. And I never got to meet him, much less work with him. I am a musician. I never was in any band that was any modicum of fame, even close to getting to consider Albini as a potential producer, engineer. He hated that term, obviously, producer, but preferred engineer, because that's what he did. And he didn't want to alter the sound of the band, and he wanted to just capture the band and set up the microphones so that the band sounds good and get the hell out of the way and let the band document the band as they were in their natural sound and their natural habitat. You know, that's what he was about. He didn't want to color the record with his techniques. And, you know, it was like, oh, this is a Steve Albini record, but you could still tell it was him because those are the records that sounded raw and real and in your face, like you were at a show. That's how you knew it was Albini, though. But because of the lack of overdose, because of the lack of effects and whatnot, that's how you knew it was Albini. So, yeah, that's what he did, and that's a big part of the legacy he left. And he just was a facilitator. And he didn't take any royalties or anything like that. He, you know, like with Nirvana, he took a flat fee and he worked off that. And apparently he got blacklisted, according to him, by Geffen Records and the whole industry. Nobody wanted to work with him. In the mid-90s, he had some lean years. He got some work here and there, but it was kind of lean for a while. And then he had a comeback in a big way, and all that bullshit fell aside. Yeah, they tried to guest cancel him. Yeah, and he was also with his provocative nature and the things he'd say. He was the edgelord before edgelords, and he got canceled before other people got canceled. So he was a trailblazer in that regard too, not just in recording. I feel like that pretty much just presented the band or the artist in the most authentic and natural light possible. He just wanted the musician to make the record. He didn't want to, he also thought it was unethical not only to take a percentage of the royalties of the residual income in the future, but also to like shape the record as an engineer or producer. It's like, oh, I hope to make that. It's like, no, fuck that. He's like, no, I'm letting the artist do that. So that's what a lot of this philosophy was based on. It was artist centered, and it was putting everything, you know, the artist just make the record. He's really a facilitator making the record the artist wants to make, and they want to sound like the artists themselves, you know? So that's what he was about. He wasn't about himself. He was about enriching the artists and helping them find their sound. In, I guess, early 1993, they were considering Steve Albini, and I guess Albini wrote them a letter stating, kind of, here, so if you want me to do the record, I'll agree, but here are the terms. And that was the famous, infamous, however you want to call it, the quote-unquote, pay me as you would a plumber letter. Basically saying, pay me for the work I do once. And, you know, he recorded it for a flat fee of, I believe it was $100,000. At least Wikipedia says that. Yes. And the studio fees totaled $24,000, which in 1983, that'd be like 50 grand a day, 2024. And it also says, at the suggestion of Albini, was worried of interference of DGC, that's the Geffen, David Geffen Company, the record label. Nirvana paid for the studio sessions with their own money, which at that time they could afford to. So $24,000 between the three of them, $8,000 each. And ain't that ain't a big thing to a newly minted millionaire like they were. So yeah. And he could have earned, I guess, over $500,000 from just this record alone. But again, he doesn't believe in royalties. And I see his argument, even though it'd be tough to, especially me coming from a broke ass background, working class, lower middle class, and working, you know, menial jobs most of my adult life. Best paying job I've ever had are the recent ones. I worked in the IT, you know, help desk, tech support, etc. But that's still pretty, at least in the IT realm, a rudimentary job. But, you know, it's good, honest work. And however, you know, it'd be tempting to get that kind of money. But I admire him for being a man of integrity and his word. And, yeah, he refused it. And he said that he would do it all over again because, you know, he's a person of integrity. You gotta admire that. And, yeah, so he wrote them that letter and they agreed, and it actually went smoother than they expected. And, you know, Kurt Cobain was expecting him to be like this sexist jerk because of the rape man and the big black and all the supposed like misogynists and potentially like problematic, like racist attitudes he had, but apparently it was the easiest recording session he ever did. And I'll get into the whole like controversy later with Steve Albini and how he apologized for some of those opinions. And I think a lot of it was just a shock value, trying to shock people. And he's being a provocateur. He did apologize for it and saw the kind of the error of his ways and became much more understanding and less of an edgelord. He was like an edgelord before there were edgelords, definitely before the internet was widespread. So, yeah, I'll get into that later, but pretty much, I mean, just talking about how he worked and, you know, he also had a disdain for the music industry, obviously. Going back to the ethics, and I love the quote that he said about Nirvana were great guys to work with and sweet dudes, and you know they were very cool and down to earth, but the hangers on everybody else who was not in the band, like the excuse me, like the record executives and the hangers on and the I don't know who else, but the biggest pieces of shit I ever met, and that's Albini's words, and I just thought that was funny. So, yeah, that's basically his modus operandi, and he just, you know, set up the mics and, you know, just let the band play and make the drums sound as natural as possible, avoid unnecessary overdubs, and was paid a flat rate that was certainly fair and you know, took into account his expertise and experience. But he didn't, you know, just milk everything for all it's worth and, you know, royalties and the residual income for a record he did once. They didn't even write. He just pressed record or whatever. And I admire the man for his integrity and his beliefs, and he stuck by them till the end. And that's pretty cool. And now I want to talk about the albums, and I'm going to start with In Utero, since I was just talking about it, and also how these albums that Steve Albini recorded shaped my personal ethic and aesthetic and how I record and how I write songs. So the first thing I want to say about In Utero is when it came out, I was in like sixth grade. I was in middle school. I don't remember exactly when I heard it or listened to it all the way through, but first time I did, it just became, I mean, I first heard the songs and the radio, like the singles, like Heart Shaped Box and All Apologies, etc. And, you know, Dumb. And it just like, it's to me, I just loved how it sounded like I was at a Nirvana show. Like Nirvana was playing a concert intimately in my house or in a small venue specifically for me and my closest friends and family, whatever. Like that's how it felt when you listen to that record. And the drums just sounded fucking phenomenal. The bass drum was just boom, boom. It sounded like John Bonham, but clearer, more articulate, more near field in your face. And it just sounded like you were right there, front and center at a Nirvana show. And the guitars were loud and extremely just pummeling, but also clear. And you could hear everything, even with the distorted part and the fuzz and all that. And the vocals, and there were actually dynamics on that record, which there aren't dynamics on records anymore, you know, the soft loud and all that. And it was just great. And that record really shaped me, and I really liked it. And it just made such a impression on me that in my formative years there as a musician, I started playing drums in like 92, so I'd only been playing drums, been a musician a couple of years, and I was like, this is my drum sound. Just like the famous story of that Chris Novoselic told of like when he and Kurt early in the band days, like, I don't know, 1989, 90, whatever, they're driving in a van and they got Surferosa on the tape deck, and Kurt points in the air and he says, issues a decree, this shall be our drum sound. Like that's how I felt about it In Utero. So yeah, it's just, man, that's just such a great drum sound and a great record and great songs, and Albini doesn't fuck it up, and Albini just kind of sets everything up to document the band at their most natural state and just gets out of the way, and it's a classic. That's why, because he did all the right things. So that, to me, that's why In Utero was great, and that's my favorite record that he produced, and it always has been, and I think it always will be, but I want to talk about a few more. So the next record I want to talk about is PG Harvey, Rid of Me. So that record was done around the same time, maybe a little earlier. Excuse the clacking. I'm looking at it. So it was released April 26, 1993, roughly 6 months before In Utero. So probably not long before. He worked with Nirvana. He worked with Paul AG, aka PJ Harvey. So that's the one with 50 Foot Queenie, a man size 50 Foot Queenie is like the weird video and all that. And, it also has a cover of Highway 61 Revisited, the Bob Dylan track, which is actually a suggestion of PJ Harvey's parents are both Bob Dylan fans. So this one is a little different. I think almost universally in the underground among indie people, it's considered incredible, just like In Utero. It's right there. There's a lot of feedback and distortion, and there's a lot of quietness, just like that's the typical Albini MO. Some people thought it was too rough, but I think it was great because it was visceral, and there were times where Polly Jean sounded like she was howling like a fucking wounded animal. And I really loved it. And my personal story with this album is I bought the CD of Rid of Me, and I've heard the songs before, and it was well versed with the album, and I hadn't really owned a copy ever, just borrowed it from the library or a friend and listened to it on, online or streaming. Or, well, there was streaming in like this. I bought it in like 2011. Yeah, because I remember. Because I used to go to Zia Records a lot, because when I delivered in the New Times, Zia Records on West Thunderbird Road near the I-17 here in Northwest Phoenix, it was on my route. And I bought it, and and obviously it's got the famous black and white photo of her topless, soaking her hair in the sink and swirling it to the side, throwing it to the side, and it's a great photo. And it's, kind of like the record itself. It's kind of raw, and it's kind of visceral, and it gets a reaction out of you, hits you in the gut, kind of. And I was going through a lot of personal time, shit in my personal life. I was depressed and struggling financially. I'd moved back in with my parents after being evicted from my apartment I had with my best friend, and I had some really unfortunate job losses, or I had a new job lined up and it fell through, and I already quit the old job, the school district, and had to sell almost everything I owned, including some cherished items like golf clubs my grandfather gave me, and things I really didn't want to sell to try and stay in the apartment. And I still nearly almost succeeded, but just fell short enough, and I got evicted. And it was a really bad experience for me, and I was going through a lot, and I was dating women, and I was just really kind of adrift and didn't really have a direction in my life. And this album, Rid of Me, really got me through some tough times. It was dark. It was visceral, primal. It really spoke to me. And he just captured her in a really raw, authentic light. And some people and some musicians, some of Polly's contemporaries didn't really care for it or understand it, but I think it's fucking genius, and I love it. And I remember those times driving around, listening to it at home, and I still revisit it here and there. And now it's going to be a little bit different mindset, I guess, knowing that Steve Albini's passed on, but it's one of his greats. I mean, people say that, Nirvana, In Utero, Pixies, Surfer Rosa, Breeders' Pod, PJ Harvey, Rid of Me. I mean, it's one of those classics for a reason. And yeah, it definitely is. And now I want to kind of turn to the third one. I'm going to choose five. So my third selection is Pod by the Breeders. Now, This was before they really became, I don't know if they were a household name, but it was really kind of before like they became as well known as they are today. I mean, they opened for this year, 2024, they opened for Olivia Rodrigo, the young up and coming pop star by her request, and she definitely has a 90s alternative rock vibe to her songs and her melodies and stuff. And the Breeders were honored, and they're old enough to be like her older aunt or aunts or almost grandmother. And but she's like, you're awesome, you know. And I thought that was really cool. And yeah, songs like Doe, where there's like that cool guitar sound, that very typical indie clean guitar, and then also Kim Deal with her eighth note bass line, like she did in the Pixies. Boom, 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 boom. A lot of that. It's just like a almost a near perfect document of indie rock circa 1990, before when it was still indie and underground, right before Nirvana just kind of crashed the, not crashed the party, but just kind of opened the floodgates, and any gatekeeping between the indie and the mainstream was over once Nevermind broke in late 1991. So that was the end. That was the end of the Indian alternative actually having meaningful connotations and not miss oxymorons, because you know it was all mainstream by that point, you know. So, and I also read about like Kim Deal also fought with Albini, Josephine Wiggs, who's British, said that she's struck with how quickly Albini and the other musicians resolved issues through short, intense arguments. An ability she attributes to their being American, which I guess compared to Brits, yeah, Americans were more direct. Some of us are. That's what, and as an aside, that's one thing about Albini I admired, and I tend to mirror that in my personal life, especially later on, you know, in my adult years, especially after like 30. I'm 42 now. Just say what I mean. I don't like mind games. I don't like passive aggressive shit. And that's how Albini is. You know where you stand with him. He won't bullshit you. He won't blow smoke up your ass. And yeah, he wanted to do two takes of each song. And that's it. And I guess Tanya Donnelly, who left after this record, was not around for Last Splash, but she went to Found Belly, you know, and also she was in Throwing Muses with Christian Hurst before that. Tanya Donnelly, anybody who knows the alternative rock scene in the 90s knows her. Great singer, songwriter, guitar player. And she had a weird quote here off the Wikipedia page. It is notated. And Donnelly, who remembers confrontations with Albini, quote, "For all the fights we had with him in the studio, and for all the times I'd stomp upstairs in my pajamas, screaming that I couldn't live with such a guitar part. Next morning, I realized he was usually right." And yeah, he was confrontational at times, but also they said he was a sweet guy and he brought out the best in him. And I really think in a lot of ways, I mean, the following record with, you know, Cannonball and all that is great. Think that went platinum. But Pod is really a great document of their sound back then, and also just alternative rock in general. And that's why it's one of my favorites of Albini's. And I want to segue to the next one. And this next one is actually the last two, starting with this next one, are great examples of his range. And he was more than just an indie slash alternative producer. So the next album from Steve Albini's immense and vaunted discography that he both played on in his bands, and also most of the majority of them that he produced for other bands, but I would have to go with "Things We Lost in the Fire" by the indie rock band Low. And if those of you who don't really know who Low is, you probably at least heard of them if you're an indie head or been following indie rock for a while. They are a band that really is kind of the whole slowcore thing, dream pop, obviously dream pop like Mazzy Star, that sort of thing, but they're quiet. Mazzy Star is pretty chill, but there's still some songs that rock a little bit. They use some distortion, but Low is very much the quote-unquote slowcore. They're very soft. I find them extremely soothing, and also they can be sad, but I just find their music very comforting. And one of the main collaborators, singers, songwriters, Mimi Parker, passed away, I think, 2-3 years ago, a couple years ago. And one of the bandmates posted a tribute on Instagram, and I saw it, and it brought me to tears. And I actually listened to Things We Lost in the Fire to prepare earlier this evening before I started recording this podcast episode. And I couldn't get through the first song, the first track, Sunflower. I was in tears over the loss of Mimi and also Steve Albini combined, and what a beautiful song it was. I lost it. I started sobbing, and I'm not really a crier usually, but man, it's the first time I've listened to this, any part of this record since he passed a few days ago. It's been a while since I've listened to it, any of the songs on there, but I really love this record because it shows so much range, and this is a very quiet band, and he just makes them sound so authentic. And the whole, like, you're at one of their shows, and it's so intimate. And he does that with a much quieter band than people usually associate with his techniques and production. And it's just great, man. It's just a great record. In fact, I would consider it the most underrated record of all the ones he produced that I've heard. Haven't heard all of them, but I can't recommend it enough. Absolutely not. In fact, I wrote that here in my pre-production notes here for this episode. It's just, you gotta hear it. And R.A.P. Mimi Parker, a gentle soul, a great artist, singer, songwriter. I believe it was cancer that took her from us, but you guys, Low will live on forever. That's why it's great that we have this wonderful music, this wonderful art to remember these people by. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little emotional here. Steve Albini left quite a discography. This will be the last record I list. And spoiler alert, it's not Surfer Rosa Pixies. That is a great record. It's hugely influential. It's listed as his biggest achievement along with In Utero. There's a good reason for that. And I love how it's produced, and it's definitely was influential. But I'm talking my personal list. I went with High on Fire, Blessed Black Wings from 2005. And again, this is the polar opposite of the last record, Low. High on Fire and Low are polar opposites, could not sound more different, at least within the greater context of the quote-unquote rock genre. It was their third, I believe, full-length album. And for the uninitiated, High on Fire is not considered indie rock or alternative. They're a quote-unquote stoner metal band. They mix bands for reference would be like Black Sabbath meets Motorhead, maybe Celtic Frost. It's a very loud, aggressive, fast, pounding, pummeling sound, very head-banging, but it's not typical thrash metal. It's a little more, I guess, primitive sounding is a way to put it. More Black Sabbath and Motorhead influence. Kind of like what fast heavy metal was before, like, Metallica's Kill 'Em All came out. But this band started in the late 90s after Sleep, kind of just, the whole thing with Jerusalem, and then that became Dope Smoker, and then it was a nightmare releasing it, and then finally it saw the light of day years later. But yeah, Matt Pike decided he wanted to found a band, and he started a band called High on Fire, and it's pretty badass. And if you're a fan of those bands, or you're a fan of the Melvins type sludgy kind of doom sludge stuff, but you also like faster stuff like Motorhead and thrash metal. It's kind of like a combination of that, for lack of a better word. They're like the other side of the stoner metal thing, like Electric Wizard's slower, more like Black Sabbath and Witchfinder General and those bands. High on Fire is like a cross between that and Motorhead and fast shit, speed metal and whatnot. So highly recommend you check them out. And that's the only record that Albini produced. And it was like the third one. And I saw them on that tour at the now defunct clubhouse in Tempe, Arizona. And Matt Pike played that show shirtless like he usually does. And he just had like a Soldano SL100 full stack. So 2 4x12 cabinets. That's 2 guitar speaker cabinets of 4 12-inch speakers each. So a total of 4 12-inch speakers and another cabinet with 4 12-inch speakers with the amp head with tubes in it on top. For those of you who are as technical or understand guitar jargon. And it was extremely loud. It sounded fucking incredible. But the thing with that show is I could not hear for days. I had ringing in my ears. They're filled with fluid, and I was scared I was going to lose my hearing. Finally went away on its own a little bit, and then I saw a doctor, and they cleared up the rest of it, prescribed me some eardrops. That was scary, and that was the last time I went to a show without protection. That was like 2005. That was on the Blessed Black Wings tour. It was like fall 2005, and that was the record that Albini did. And the first, the absolute first thing you hear when you put that album on is the fade in of the drums for the opener, Devolution, and that is a Des Kinsey. I can't really do it with my mouth, but it's awesome. Just check it out. I think he just does it with one bass drum. It's not even double bass, but he just does this snare and tom run thing, and it's awesome. And Albini just recorded the drums perfectly like he always does. Also, I think Cometh Down Hessian or whatever, that's a really cool track. And it's a dark, sparse, like he really made High and Far sound good. I wish he would have produced another record. I don't think he did. And I don't know if I've heard Matt Pike talk about it, but I thought that was a really good record. They sounded really good. So High on Fire, Blessed Black Wings, came out roughly 2005. The Low record came out in 2001. So, well, I almost went in chronological order. In Utero was the first one I said, and that was like late 93. PJ Harvey one was like 6 months before. Rears Pod was in 90. And then Low, Things We Lost in Fire was 2001, and High on Fire, Blessed Black Wings is 2005. So he did do another quote-unquote metal band called Code Orange and not too long ago, I think, and that was one of the last records he did, I heard. And that's like a new metal type, like really thrashy, like rah, that kind of stuff. So you wouldn't picture him doing that, but hey, it was Steve Albini. He was a man of, you know, He believed in working for the musicians, and I think he was up for a challenge, and he was a man of integrity, and it showed in the albums he made and people speaking highly of him during his life and upon his passing. So now I kind of want to transition here and start talking about Steve Albini, the person. So in discussing Steve Albini, the person, especially when it comes to his personal reputation, he was definitely known as being acerbic, sarcastic, brash, and at times offensive when expressing his views. Some people would say in spite of, but I would say probably related to the fact that he was just extremely off the charts intelligent, and also his uncompromising ethos. I think that lent itself very much to his abrasive personality. And obviously a big part of that, a famous example of that controversy, is one of his bands. Three main bands were Big Black, Shellac, and the infamous Rape Band. And he named it Rape Man on purpose, and he did it to get a rise, especially out of like hardcore feminists. And predictably, it drew the ire of women's rights activists, and some of them protested the banned shows. And Rape Man had protesters outside, and you know, at the time, he'd like blow them off, say, "Oh, you know, it's just a joke. Don't be so politically correct," and this and that. He was kind of an edgelord before the term edgelord even existed. I mean, Steve Albini is like the OG edgelord. At least those of us who are like underground, like music fans, that's the first guy that comes to mind, a provocateur, a guy being edgy. That's Albini. And he was, you know, kind of a nerd and super smart and kind of an anorak. And he just fit the whole stereotype, you know, in a way. And he also wrote lyrics, I think mainly in Rape Man and maybe perhaps in Big Black too. I know the cover of Songs About Fucking, which has like a green background and also that kind of anime looking illustration or whatever of a woman with kind of that bob haircut, dark short hair, kind of like Snow White, and she's like, you know clenching shut her eyes and clenching her teeth like she's being, you know, fucked, like in intercourse. And some people thought that was kind of misogynistic. He wrote songs that are misogynistic and some are just kind of goofy. Like, I think he wrote a song called Kim Gordon's Panties, like Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth, who actually became friends with her. He was actually friends with the Sonic Youth folks, and they paid tribute to him when he passed. So he was on good terms with them, but he just kind of said whatever the hell he wanted. And he really was just trying to get a rise out of people, but he did realize as he got older, you know, some of the stuff, especially calling on a band Rape Man, that's not cool. And he said he's tried to align himself with women's rights, and he's tried to be a good man and not patriarchal, not, you know, the toxic masculinity stuff. But he was, I mean, I think most of us know that he probably has already always been that way, but he probably just wanted to be a provocateur and, you know, talk shit and stir shit up. That's who Albini was. He was really a good dude at the heart of it all. He had a good heart. That's what everybody says worked with him during the time he was quote unquote an asshole. He was the sweetest guy, but he took no shit, and he stood up for himself, and he got blacklisted, according to the Conan O'Brien interview he did just like a few months ago, you know, before he died, for the 30th anniversary of In Utero. And he said he got blacklisted by Geffen Records because they didn't like the record he did, and they tried to steer all these young bands who were pretty big names from working with him. He ran into some problems, and then he did the Page and Plant record in like 96, 97 because, well, he did a Bush record. I think he did the Razorblade Suitcase, and then he did a Page and Plant record because he couldn't get enough business from the alternative rock world. And also, he grew up idolizing Led Zeppelin, so he said that was pretty cool. But yeah. His integrity and his sticking to his guns cost him. It did, but he said he'd do it again. But however, going back to the offensive part of it and the shock value, he expressed regret for that. And he said in an interview a couple of years ago, maybe a few years ago, that came from privilege, obviously him being white and male. And, you know, it's just, he didn't mean it that way. And he apologized, and he says he tries to be a good ally for feminism and, you know, civil rights and all that, so, and LGBTQ, etc. So he was a good dude. I mean, he just said some things, and he apologized if he, you know, for being offensive needlessly, and some things he went too far, I agree, but he grew quite a lot, and people commended him for that, for having the self-awareness to say, yeah, I need to change some things, and I need to make, apologize for some things I'd said and did in the past, right some wrongs, and he did. And then when he passed, people were stunned. You know, the way he passed, just heart attack. You're here 1 minute, then you keel over and die. Especially he did it doing what he loved. Got a lot of people by surprise, that's for sure. And, you know, I think... In the shock, though, people realized that, wow, that was pretty special getting to work with him. I wish I would have gotten to work with him. I was never in a band anywhere near popular enough to even consider affording his services, even though he was very fair. And I looked at his website like the day he died, and the rates were still up there. It was like, I think it was like $900 a day, the engineer. And then you had to pay like between $450 and $650 for the studio fee. It's still the studio and Albini see like $1,500 a day, and you do a record in like maybe, I don't know, 5 days, $7,500. That's not bad. Too bad I can't afford that, but now I can't do that. So I'll stick to home recording with my interface and my trusty mic here, my SM7B and my Pro Tools intro, which, hey, free version of Pro Tools. Pro Tools doesn't need me shelling away from them, but no, seriously, this is honest review. It's pretty good. And I've used Cubase, I've used Reaper, I've used PreSonus Studio One. I've used a few DAWs, GarageBand. This is the industry standard for a reason. It's easy to sound professional without too much tinkering. It's pretty plug and play, and it's free. You're just limited to like 8 audio, 8 MIDI, and 8 instrument tracks. But it's cool. Anyway, back to Steve Albini. So yeah, the eulogy's poured in, and my favorite quote was from none other than Dave Grohl, drummer of Nirvana. Obviously went on to Foo Fighters and incredible fame there. Incredible success, but obviously Nirvana was incredibly successful too. I would argue even more so. But anyway, he said of Steve Albini, quote, he was smarter and funnier and better at everything than everyone else in the world. And he, thing I haven't mentioned yet, it's not really relevant to the music angle of this podcast, but he was a 2-time World Series of Poker bracelet winner. And that's a big deal. And he didn't really play No Limit Hold'em, but he played like the mixed games, like the ones that mix like Limit Hold'em and Pot Limit Omaha and 7-Card Stud. So basically, he was well-versed and played a lot of different poker games, and he was pretty damn good at them. And he made some money, not a ton. He did pretty well for himself. And also, I read that, actually, I remember seeing he had a cooking vlog like, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And he talked about like making steak and stuff like that. It sounded really good. And actually, now I'm a, you know, fairly, you know, I'm a pretty passionate home cook now. I'm not like great or anything, not like advanced, but there's a number of few things that I cook pretty well. And I thought, wow, that makes me want to get into cooking. And then I did. And then when he passed, that's the thing I thought of when I saw Dave Grohl's quote. It's better at everything than everyone else in the world. It's like, oh yeah, he was a poker player. Heard he was a damn good cook, and he's good at other things too. I forgot. Those are the big ones. But yeah. And I dabble in other things as well. You know, do the music, do tech. I've dabbled in poker. I've never played a in-person tournament, like at a casino. I've won and done okay in some like poker pub tournaments, but nothing like World Series of Poker like he did. I mean, he did the real thing. But hopefully someday soon I'll get to do that. I don't know. Be nice. But yeah, I kind of just want to end this by summarizing, you know, we talked about his life, his discography, his personal life, his journey from this like agitator and, you know, guy smarter than everybody else, and people thought he was a dick, even though he was usually right, despite being highly opinionated and intelligence off the charts. And then later in his years, he softened a bit. And, you know, and also I was watching earlier on YouTube, Electrical Audio did some how-tos with Steve Albini, and they're kind of funny, and there's a little corny humor in it and little effects and whatnot. But the information's really good, like how to make a guitar speaker and all that, and record drums, and it's pretty cool. And it's cool that he took the time to record all that and help people out, especially fledgling audio engineers and home recorders like myself and others. So yeah, basically I just want to kind of wrap this up here. We're getting towards, you know, with the intro music and all that, it's going to be around an hour. I try to keep these podcasts around an hour, not songs, we talked about some songs, but I kind of just want to end it with saying two things. First, if I could say something to Steve Albini, I'd say thank you, Steve, for being your true authentic self and recording the bands and artists you worked with, busting your ass for them and recording them as their true authentic selves, and for standing for something and not being afraid to admit you were wrong when you were wrong, but also never backing down when you knew you were right. And thank you for the great records, and thank you for the audio engineering tips. And most of all, man, just thank you for being you. The world really needed you, man, and you were here for 61 years and you did a lot of good. And I already miss you, but we got a lot to go off of and we're going to remember you. And I just went off the cuff there and just said what I feel in my heart. And I just went from the heart, and God damn it, man, this sucks. But we're going to fly your flag, Steve. Steve Albini, we're going to carry on for you. We're going to do things with your integrity and your passion and your wisdom, and we're just going to soak it all up with what you've left us, and that's quite a bit. That's quite a lot. And from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for it. And rest easy, man. Hopefully I'll see you on the other side and we'll finally get to meet and I'll get to tell you how awesome you are. Maybe you can critique my songs, although I'm kind of afraid of what you might say, but hey, it's all good. I know you would come from a place of just trying to help me constructively, right? So it's all good. And I want to say one more thing before I sign off. And it's about to be Mother's Day here where I am in Arizona. Not big on holidays, but if you do not have your mother or do not have a relationship with her, I feel for you. I am extremely fortunate to still have my mom and have a good relationship with her. And she's supposed to come over tomorrow and we're going to have dinner, and I'm very looking forward to it and spending time with her while I still can. And if there's a lesson from all of this with Steve Albini, life is precious and it's fleeting. I'm going to try to keep my emotions in check here, but we saw this with Chris Cornell and Anthony Bourdain and so many others, and now Steve Albini. Everybody, we don't know when our time comes. You don't know, I don't know. No one fucking knows. Right? So just live your life and treat everybody well and be kind and understanding, as compassionate as you can. And I know there's things I need to work on, and I'm not perfect, but live in the moment, live in the now. Tell people you love them if you love them, and tell people what they mean to you. And just live your life and be grateful however long it lasts. And I think that's what Steve Albini would want us to do too. Because he sure as hell made the most of his time here. I think we can all agree it ended too soon, but goddamn, he left a legacy. I don't know what else to say, so I'm going to leave it there. Once again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for everybody who tuned in, streamed this podcast episode, listened to it. Thanks for joining me. I hope you enjoyed, even though it's with heavy hearts, this tribute to Steve Albini, and have a great day or night wherever you are, whatever time it is, and go forth and create and be good to each other. Hopefully we'll be talking more soon. My health issues seem to be getting better. I felt good enough to do this tribute to Steve, so who knows? Keep me in your thoughts, prayers, send good vibes, whatever. I'd appreciate it too. I mean, I think we could all use some of that right now, right? So Till next time, I hope to talk to you again soon, and hope you've enjoyed this.